Good morning. My name's Gordon. I'm a recovering alcoholic. I say recovering, and I'll be recovering till the good Lord calls me home. Then I will be a recovered alcoholic. My birthday in AA is 6th of August, 1965. I was what you call a fallen down drunk. I started drinking at the age of 8 and progressed on up to the age of 33. At the age of 33, I had an awakening from a good man that I used to work off and on with, and he gave me the chance to start my life anew. But my drinking back when I was young was back during the Depression. My mother used to feed us kids a little beer in our glass so we could have something in our stomachs to go to bed with. I worked on a dairy farm for $10 a month. Room and board. I worked there 1 month. He put that job in. I went to work on a truck farm, hoeing corn and picking taters and corn and stuff like that. I worked there for 4 years. I went in the service, United States Navy. I didn't have no clothes when I was a kid. I had no clothes when I was a kid. Mother raising 8 children on what Dad brought home, and that wasn't a heck of a lot of money back then. I had kids scoffed me and pushed me around. I had holes in my shoes and holes in my pants. And I didn't go to schools often. So I'm a self-taught reader, a self-taught writer. I taught all my own skills from myself. As I tell my kids, I've worked from the age of 8 up, and I'm proud of every hard hour that I put in. I drove tractor trailer from 1959 up to 2011, 52 years. In the first, from 59 to 65, I drove tractor trailer over the countrysides and through towns and villages and school zones under the influence of drugs and alcohol. Alcohol, no drugs, alcohol. My drug of choice was cigarettes and tobacco, cigars and stuff. I couldn't find work. They'd work me 1 day a week, 2 days a week, and that went on from 59 to 65. And this gentleman said to me one day, "Gordy," he says, "you want a steady job?" I said, "I sure do." He says, "I got a steady job for you, but we got a problem." And I said, "What's the problem, Bob?" He says, "I can't have 2 drunks in the company. And one of us is going to quit. And if you want the job, you got it." So I quit drinking right there. Quit drinking and smoking. And my life started changing. I was known around the town as a filthy mouth drunk. I used that F word just about every other word. And it's degrading, I'll tell you. I got married in 1951. To my wife, well, her and I will be celebrating 64 years this October. I'll be celebrating 83 years of walking this earth. And it's the last 50 years of this 83 years has been marvelous. It has really been marvelous. I go into the prison. I've been volunteering in prisons, spreading the word and trying to give joy and hope to those men that are locked up. And some of my friends are sitting out here in the audience today. God bless them. And I see one young gentleman here that had 31 years in a prison and come out and And he just makes my life just so much better. Knowing that there are some people in prison that can come out and spread the joy that should be spread in around the world instead of all this gloom and doom. I'm a pastoral care pastor in my church, and a gentleman gave me that opportunity to do that, visiting the sick and the lonely and attending those who are about ready to go to the new world. I enjoy going to it's just to sit there and listen, you know, to hear their stories sometimes before they go on. The joy that they give to their people, that their little children that they brought up. My wife and I raised 7 children, 6 boys and a girl. We lost 2 of my boys. One was killed on my motorcycle in 1980. He came home from Indianapolis, Indiana, where he worked out there on his motorcycle. He ran out of gas in Hornell, New York, and the cops put him in jail overnight so he'd have a place to sleep. Bought him 2 gallons of gas the next morning so he could continue his home. I came home and he was sitting there in the chair, and I just sat down beside him. I didn't recognize him because it was late in the evening. And he says, "Aren't you going to say hello to me, Dad?" And boy, I tell you, that was something. That was something. He says, "I'm home to stay." I said, "That's nice." That was on a Sunday. Tuesday, he said, "Dad, can I borrow your bike?" He says, my bike ran out of license plate expired. I said, "Sure." So he took my motorcycle. I went to work. They called me up in Corning, New York. I was delivering some goods up there. And I said, "Get right back here. You missed something. It's real important. You got to pick this up." I went back. My wife said, "He's gone." I said, "Who's gone?" He says, "Our son, Larry. He was killed this morning, a mile from our house. He was a good kid. He's a good kid. All my kids are good, you know. But I got into this program. I was going to go to jail. I got myself in a jam, and I can't remember it. But I'm coming out of this fog, and I'm standing in front of this judge, and he's going to send me to prison. He says, "You're going to go away." He says, "I don't care. You're going to go away." But some of the people that I used to work with, they come forward with affidavits telling me what a great guy I was, how hard I worked, how I'm turning my life around. He said, "I'm going to give you 6 months to get yourself turned around, get a psychiatrist, a psychologist, get a church, and turn your life around." And I'd done all that in 6 months, and he was surprised. And my preacher said to me, "Gordy," he says, "you got to learn to lead a better life." So he started me on this road of recovery. You know, I could have come into this program back in 65, but I was one of those diehard, "I don't need you people, I can do it on myself." You know, I had a brother-in-law and a brother in this program. They begged me to come in. "I don't need you drunks. You know, I don't need to listen to you bunch of drunks. I know how to drink." Well, I'll tell you, I wish I took their advice and come in 65 instead of waiting. But the only requirement for Alcoholics Anonymous is the desire to stop drinking. It doesn't say you have to come right into the program or off the street. You have to have a few hard knocks, and I took mine. And I earned every one of them. I've learned the joy of this program. I'm living today. God has given me that right, whether God is your higher power or whatever, but God is my higher power. I love to help people. You know, my grandmama, I used to think she was the meanest little old lady, that little old German lady like that, used to say to me, "You tip your hat to people. You say yes, sir. You say no, ma'am. You say thank you. Welcome." She lived in Williamsport, Pennsylvania, and there used to be a pretzel factory across the park. And she'd send my kid brother and I over to get a peck bag of pretzels, broken pretzels, for a dime. And she'd say, "Don't you eat one of them pretzels. I know how many's in that bag." So we'd go over and we'd get that pretzels, and the guy over the pretzel said, "Now don't remember, your grandma says don't eat one of them pretzels. She knows how many's in there." And he'd give us each one off the thing. And she'd tell us, "You will be respectful to your elders." She says, "Little children, little boys and girls should be seen and not heard." And that's the way I was brought up. And I try to teach that to my children, but they don't listen. You know, my oldest is 62 years old, and my youngest is 51. My youngest just got out of prison, 25 years. But I've seen a change in him. I see a change in him. He does everything for his mother. He gets up sometimes 4 o'clock. I got up the other day, and he's up 4 o'clock in the morning washing the walls down and the ceiling down and doing the kitchen cupboards. He does some cooking and baking. He goes with, he takes his mother to the grocery store, to the doctor's, when I can't do it. So he's got the joy of living, but he just hasn't got the right part of it yet. I buried one of my oldest. He died of cancer. He just wanted to live long enough that he said to the doctors, "I just want to live long enough to see, to hold my first grandchild." And he done that. And I walked up, and he was laboring there in the hospital, and I leaned over and I said, "You know, son, don't suffer no more. God is here and the angels are working, who are waiting to take you, and you're going to a better place." And he closed his eyes and squeezed my hand. My sister, 92, she never, when I got my troubles, she was always there. "You're not the kind of person. You can do better. Spread some joy in your life. Go out and enjoy yourself." I buried her just before Christmas last year. And this year, just before the end of March, I buried my two brothers. 88 years old, the oldest, and 80 years old, my kid brother. He was a full-blown alcoholic. I tried to save him, but there was no saving him. But I went up and I had joy. We laughed and we talked, and he felt a lot better knowing that he was going to a better place. So if you want a better life than what you get, and you got a better life right now because you're in the AA program, you can't be in a better program. I don't think there's a better survival program in the world than AA. But if you want to put a little more joy in your life, go visit some of these people in your church that don't get visited. Go visit a vet in a veterans hospital. God bless every one of them. For it wasn't for the veterans that give their life and their all for the country, we wouldn't be here today doing this. Spread some joy. Take your kids, go for a walk. Take your wife and take a drive out in the country and smell the roses. I took my wife across country and she never seen such beauty. I never seen the beauty in this country either until I quit drinking and started driving across country. I seen the trotting down people sleeping in hallways down the street corners. I was in Hawaii and there was a little old lady had a push cart and five cats in it. And every morning I'd go for a 5 mile walk and I'd go by and I'd slip $2 in her kitty so she could, for the cats could be fed or she could have a salmon. And she always said, God bless you. Today, when I go down the street and I see, it doesn't matter if you're an old couple or a young couple, tip my hat, because I always wear a hat, tip my hat, good morning, how are you today? Or hold the door open for an elderly person while they got packaged, or a young person that they got a couple kids in tow, hold the door open. Some of them say thank you, and those that don't say thank you, I say you're welcome. Yeah. But you got to get out, you know, you can't stay in your house. You got to get out in the world and spread some joy. Spread some joy in your life. Don't sit home like a bunch of mumps on a log. I want to thank my good friend John and his lovely wife for letting this old man tag along on this journey. They were real special people to me. Bob, Tom over there, God bless you. You're an inspiration to me, and I'll never forget you as long as I live. And those guys that you spent time with, they're in my heart all the time. And maybe someday I can go back into the prison. But my doctor pulled me out on a health reason. And I miss them guys. Because they're no better and I'm no better than they are. I was that close to going in there. And I used to deliver in that place before I started going in and before I got sober. And I used to drive by, you guys got everything you got coming to you and you should have more time. I don't think that way no more. I tried to spread a little joy into their lives by attending their meetings, and I hope I did. I hope I helped somebody. I know there's a lot of young kids in these prisons today, 17 years old, some of them facing life without parole. You know, what a waste of life. What a waste of life. Young kids in high school can't get their marks up, don't want to get their marks up. Bullying other little kids, picking on somebody. A waste of time, waste of life. The joy of living is what we're here today for. And I'm telling you people, this is my joy right here. This is beyond any of my expectations that I ever thought of. A fallen down drunk, 83 years old, 50 years recovery. Standing before a crowd here, and this is a crowd. I don't have this many people in my parish. I'm lucky if I have 15 people on Sunday. Nobody goes to church anymore. They haven't got time. Nobody goes out and enjoys their life. They haven't got time. But they got time to pick up that bottle. They got time to get that stuff and stick it in their arm. No joy there. No joy there. 1 minute. This beautiful lady here says 1 minute. And I'm going to her warning, you know. I've been hammered off of these meetings so many times back home. I get to talk and I don't know when to shut up. You know. But it's a pleasure to be here, and God bless each and every one of you. And I hope you can go out and spread some joy. Tip your hat to an old lady. Help her across the street. Somebody said, well, what if she don't want to go across the street? Help her back across that. You know? But do something. Do something for a young kid. Take a young kid to the VA hospital and show them what it's all about. Ask these gentlemen sitting in wheelchairs with no legs or arms. God bless them, you know. Nobody was here for me when I came out of the Korean War. But I'm here for them to come out of any war you've ever been in, World War I, World War II, Korea, and all these other places. Vietnam, God bless you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Gordon. That was wonderful. And our next speaker is Sue from Indiana. Give her a warm welcome.
Good morning. This is the audience participation part of the program.
If you're joyful and you know it, clap your hands. If you're joyful and you know it, clap your hands. If you're joyful and you know it, then your life will surely show it. If you're happy and you know it, clap your hands.
All right. My name is Sue. I am an alcoholic. And I'm dry in terms of sobriety, but I am all wet. I love the rain, and I didn't mind walking over in the rain. I'm soaking wet. I fussed this morning to make sure my hair was all fine, and I'm like a drowned rat. I am going to ask Amy to give me the 3-minute nudge that I'm getting close, because I can't wrap anything up in 1 minute. So I wanted to start off this morning by asking how many people we have here with like a year or less of sobriety. Do we have anybody? I see one hand, two hands. The lights are glaring, so I can't really see you very well. But really, I'm going to be talking to you guys. And I think what's going to happen is if I don't preface my remarks by saying you're going to think I'm lying a lot, you might not get it. When I got here and people were talking a lot about, I'm so grateful to be sober and I'm so grateful to be an alcoholic and life is just so joyful, I thought they were all lying. I didn't believe a one of them. Nobody could love living sober if they ever felt the way that I felt when I got here. I walked in depressed. I walked in self-pity. In fact, let me tell you, my very first gratitude list, some woman with 33 years of sobriety, if you can imagine that, had the gall to tell me to write a gratitude list. She must have thought something was missing in my life. So I went home and I wrote the gratitude list, not because I thought it would be helpful, not because I thought it was valuable, only because I was afraid that if she asked me, I had better be able to say, yes, I had written it. So I go home, I sit down with a piece of paper, and I write the gratitude list. And just then my cat jumped up on my lap. And I wrote down, okay, I'm grateful for my cat because she's the only one who really loves me. A little self-pity, perhaps. And I want you to know that because you have to know where I came from to understand where I am today. I came from self-pity. I was 16 years old when I sat at my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't get sober at that time. It took me 8 years to get a year of sobriety. So I'm kind of a slowly. I'm a slipper. I'm a slider. Or I was. Today, with the grace of God and great sponsorship, I have 34 years of sobriety. And thank you for that. Thank you for that. We all know that my sobriety is because of the grace of God and this beautiful fellowship. Hi, Pat. I didn't know you were going to be here. Oh, hi. Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Okay, so I have an honesty crew here this morning. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. Stand up. These are the people who are going to keep me honest. They say they came to give me support. They came here to give me support? No, they came to make sure I was telling the truth. I know these people. I am joyful in sobriety, and maybe you can already tell that. Maybe you can already tell that. And for those who are new, I mean it. I came from being suicidal and depressed when I got here to just loving life. And these two people over here have been in my house. In fact, one of them lives in my house. And they see me on a daily basis. They see the life that I live on a daily basis. And they see how many people come in and out of my house, working the steps, the number of phone calls I get. And it is exactly the working with others that has brought joy into my life. The 12 steps says, we, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we try to carry the message. I will tell you in my story, my spiritual life, my spiritual awakening absolutely came as the result of the steps. I know other people come here with an already established spiritual basis. I didn't have any of that. My spiritual life today came exactly like it says in the book through the 12 steps. And it also says in our book that nothing will so much ensure our own sobriety as intense work with other alcoholics. When I got to the part of working the program where I was supposed to go, like, carry the message, I was supposed to help somebody else, I felt inadequate. I felt ill-prepared. I felt like I didn't really have anything to offer. I didn't have anything to give. I felt like I was still quite needy. Of course I'm needy. And I was told just to share my experience, strength, and hope, and that would be enough. I didn't have to be a guru. I didn't have to have the answers. I didn't have to be more than I was, that who I am is enough. The experience I have is enough. And that somebody would identify with that, and it would be enough. And so, in my own feeble way, I started reaching out and working with others. And I started to watch it happening. The first time it happened for me, I was working with a gal in a halfway house. They would only let her out if she was with her sponsor. And so I would go and pick her up, and we would go to a local park, and we would talk through the steps and walk through the steps and share. And one day in the park, just she and I, we knelt down on the grass and we said the third step prayer. And when she raised her eyes up, her eyes had changed. I saw it. I'm getting chills right now. I saw it happen for her. I saw a shift in her awareness, in her consciousness. And I felt the privilege, the absolute privilege of being present in that moment of her transition, of her beginning transition. I was no longer self-conscious. I was so focused on her and her joy and her beginning into a new life. And I went away from there, I suspect, more grateful than she was. And that was the beginning of my journey into the joy of helping others. I had witnessed the joy of helping others before. When I was 16 and I came into the program, there was a fella in my hometown who had been literally the town drunk. I mean, he was kind of the Otis of Mayberry, you know. He was definitely the town drunk. And his name was Happy Love. What a great name. Isn't that a great name? Happy Love. And Happy Love would stop by and pick me up. I was 16 years old. It was during the summer. I wasn't in school. And he would stop by and say, come on, we're going to go do some 12-step work. And at that time, you could walk into the hospital, and they would hand Happy a slip of paper with all the drunks that had been checked in the night before, over the weekend. Now, today you can't do that because of different laws and stuff. But he would get this list, and we'd start down the hall, and he'd say, you wait a minute, because he'd go in and make sure the men were properly dressed. And then I would go and sit down next to Hap, and he would ask if he could tell his story. It was good old-fashioned 12-step work. And he would say, man, I used to be bad to drink, and I don't drink now, and I have a solution that was shared with me, and I'd love to share it with you. It would really help me if you'd let me tell my story. And he would tell his story, and these men would listen intently, trying to help him by listening to his story. So I learned really early on how to do that. I just didn't realize it was much later that I realized that Hap was really telling me how to do the deal. And he really was happy. And he really was all about love. I watch lights turn on in the eyes of others all the time. Nod your heads if you agree. They go, yes, they agree. I'm never happier than when there's somebody sitting in my living room and we're going through the steps. It is absolutely the joy of my life. It's an experience you will not want to miss. And for those of you who are new here, and you're not in the place where you feel like you're ready to carry the message and you're ready to do the deal, let me tell you something else. When the gals that I sponsor are through the steps and I say, now go snag on to some newcomers. You know, that's what we do. We say, you know, go get them. You know, you're not going to meetings for yourself anymore. You're going to meetings trolling for newcomers. That's what you're doing. You grab a hold of them. You get their phone number. You give them your phone number. And you call them. And you grab a hold of somebody and you become a sponsor. You don't have to do it alone. First time you're sponsoring somebody, it can be a little intimidating. That uncertainty, that am I doing things right? Do I have the right message to carry? We never do it alone. One of the things I love as much as taking people through the steps is sponsoring people into being sponsors. And if you're not sponsoring people into being sponsors, you're missing out on it. You never have to do it alone. You know, if you don't have the answer for somebody, call me. We'll talk through it. And if I don't have the answer, I'll call my sponsor. And if she doesn't have the answer, we'll call her sponsor. And somewhere down the line, one of these old women is going to have a solution. You know? That's just the way it works. We don't ever have to do any of this alone. Even sponsorship, and I think I'm about ready to knock this podium off the... For the next speaker, it's a little loose. I'm just warning you. It's better than me being a little loose. Another piece of the joy of helping others is to remember that when I ask for help myself, I'm giving the privilege of help someone else helping me, and the joy of that. Let me tell you the story here. A few years back, I became quite ill. And my house was getting to be in disarray. I could hardly take care of myself, let alone the house, the yard, everything else. And I finally had to cry uncle. And I grabbed one of the gals I sponsored, Debbie. You guys know that, yeah. I had to grab a hold of Debbie and say, I need help. I'm physically sick, and because I can't take care of myself and I can't take care of my house, I'm becoming depressed. And something's got to give. I need some help. You know what Debbie did? God bless her little heart. She called all of the newest newcomers she could find and said, come on over to Sue's. We got some work to do. And it was pretty humbling to have all these newcomers coming into my home and seeing the disarray that I was in because of my illness. But those gals came in. They cleaned my house. They organized things. They mowed the lawn. They even planted flowers before they were gone. Those gals became a sisterhood. The act of being of service to me brought them together, and they have been bonded ever since. And that's been a number of years back. So by asking for help, I give someone else the joy of helping as well. And I can never get too big for AA where I can't say I need help. I can never get so too big for AA where I can't offer the privilege of being of service to someone else. I really am grateful for my cats. They really do love me. And I really do miss them while I'm gone. I have 5 now. I only had 1 at the time. I'm not sure what else to say. I may not need a 3-minute. I may be... Oh, I've got 5 minutes. I may not fill my full time. I will just tell you that the process of going from being suicidal and full of self-pity to living in joy has exactly been as it's lined out in the big book. And that may sound dull, and it may not sound real special, but it's the truth. Through working the steps with a sponsor through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have found a gratitude and a joy that I never ever thought would be possible. And it shows most minutes of most days in my life. And they're nodding. Because I'll make them pay if they don't nod. I want to thank you for allowing me the privilege of sharing with you this morning. My name is Sue, and I am an alcoholic.
Thank you, Sue. And last but not least, we have Tom Z from Virginia. Give it up for Tom.
Hi, everybody. I'm Tom. I am an alcoholic, and I am from lovely Virginia, the real state, not West Virginia. Kathy's not here, right? My sobriety date, I'm the baby here, evidently, is May 7th, 1991. Thank you. My home group is the Woodbridge Group in lovely Woodbridge, Virginia, in the Woodbridge District. I'm really looking forward to this. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, helping others was a totally foreign concept to me. I was probably the most self-centered, egotistical person that you or anybody else had ever met. I was the center of the universe. God was very good to me. He made sure that I was in enough trouble that I was willing to listen as only the dying can. I got here through the recommendation of my lawyer that if I didn't want to spend the rest of my life in the penitentiary, that I would do something about my drinking and drugging. And I went to rehab after he explained what rehab was. I lasted 17 days, and I was therapeutically discharged. That's what happens when you dispense narcotics on the addictions unit. I went to my next rehab, and they would only take me if I signed a contract. And the first thing I had to do was get a sponsor. And I got a sponsor, and... this guy was an old-fashioned kind of guy, big book thumper, big book Nazi. They used to call him all kinds of things back then. And he laid out a program of recovery for me, and Well, first he said, tell me your story, and I did, and I ended it with, but I don't think I'm an alcoholic or a drug addict. I just got bad luck. And he said, let me see if I understand this right. You just got out of jail. You just got kicked out of rehab. You're in your second rehab. You are facing 85 years in the penitentiary, and your life's not unmanageable. You're one of two things. You're either stupid or you're retarded. So he had me go back to my room that night and tell my own story of myself in the mirror. And by the time I was halfway through, I didn't know who I was talking to. I didn't know who that monster was that I was looking at. I went to bed that night, and I couldn't sleep. And I got out of bed, got on my knees, and I asked God for help. And I said, I'll do whatever it takes. Well, I went back the next day, and I said, okay, I'm all yours. Tell me what to do, and I'll do it. And, you know, he laid out a program, and he made me a promise that night. And he told me that if I didn't quit before the miracle happened, I could know a way of life greater than anything I could imagine. And I just looked at him like he had two heads, and I went, okay. And we started working together. And then he asked me, do you just want to not drink, or do you want to be happy, joyous, and free? And I went, hell, I want to be happy, joyous, and free. And then he said, okay, well, then you have to get involved. You have to do service work. No. Okay. So he told me to meet him at this church at 7 o'clock on a Wednesday night. And I look into where and when. This is an 8:30 meeting. So, you know, this brain, this must be one special job. I got my Cadillac detailed. I bought a new suit. I showed up. And he looked at me, and he got to giggling, and he, you know, come on. And he handed me a box of the nastiest ashtrays, a bottle of bleach, and a scrub brush, and told me to clean them all and don't tell anybody I did it. Now, Tom was not a happy camper. I think the word was humility. He had this thing where he'd always, you know, I'd say something or do something, and he'd always hit himself on the head and go, I forgot how smart you are, you know. But, you know, I finally, you know, you hear when you come in, you know, you got to work the steps, you got to work steps, you got to work steps. Well, finally through working the steps, and then finally by living the steps, things began to change in my life. You know, I couldn't think my way into better living. I had to work my way into better thinking, you know. And I started volunteering at the addictions unit at Arlington Hospital because I was a poster boy for knuckleheads. You know, they had me talk to any guy that was a problem child. I was their guy to talk to. my sponsor, like I said, was very big in the big book. And, you know, he read the last three paragraphs of the spiritual experience to me that first night. And then he threw the big book at me and told me my job was to study it and his job was to answer all my questions. And I remember asking him, you know, the first question was, spiritual principles would solve all my problems. You know, what does that mean? And he told me that, you know, by working the practicing the steps in my life on a daily basis to the best of my ability, I would never have to drink again. And I said, okay, I can understand that. And I've tried to do that for the last 24 and a half years. I see in numerous places in the big book where it tells me that I am to be of maximum service to my God and those about me. And I have found that God has always put just the right person just the right place at just the right time to teach me what I needed to learn. I truly believe that everybody in this program has their own passion. Mine is corrections. You know, like I said, when I got here, I had lost the ability to smile. I basically was a miserable guy. You know, I had this export-import business that was making a ton of money, but I was just really just hopelessly miserable. You know, while I woke up the first, every morning for the first 9.5 months of my recovery, I woke up thinking or wondering, am I going to spend the rest of my life in the penitentiary? Well, I found out that I wasn't going to spend. I was very, very fortunate. I only spent a year in jail. Well, there was a guy, name was Craig, who brought one meeting a week into the jail I was at. And I went, I never missed a meeting. You talk about a hard place to practice these principles in all your affairs, do it in a jail or penitentiary. And I had somebody write me through the correspondence program out of New York. Well, as soon as I got out, I started writing to somebody. And I've been doing that for over, 21 years. And I want to tell you two stories about corrections. I was writing this one gentleman for over 15 years. And he was supposed to, he finally was going to make parole. And he got real sick. And I thought he died because I hadn't heard from him for the last couple of months. And this past Christmas Day, I got a phone call. And I didn't know the number, so I didn't pick up the phone. And I hear this message, "Hey, Tom, it's Keith." And I almost fell over the table as I jumped over the table and picked it up. And it was Keith. He'd finally been released. And he was doing well. And 2 days before we left to come here, there was a message on my machine. I'll get to this later. But, "Hey, I'm sitting here at the AA club in Houston, and I just got done cleaning up, and I'm going to be here all day until the next meeting." He goes to the meeting every day. And he'd been locked up for like 17 years or so. And, he's doing great. And it just blows my mind. I got involved with taking meetings into the jail because my sponsor said I was turning into a bonehead. And it was just like a OJ kind of thing. He told me to be at McDonald's at 6 o'clock and there'll be a white Bronco, get in it. I'm going, okay. And I get there. "You, Tom? Yeah, get in." "Where are we going?" "You'll find out." this guy takes me. We get almost there, and I know where we're going then. I'm trying to get out. I'm going to jump out the door. And the guy hits the old switch to lock the windows and the door so I can't open it. And he pulls into Lorton Penitentiary, which is the nastiest probably place in the world. So we get there. Well, then he says, "Come on." "No." He says, "Get out." "No." He says, "Don't make me pull you out of here." And this guy was a pretty big dude. And I got out, and I was like a little girl, man. I don't want to go. And so we went in, had a meeting, and came back out. He goes, "Well, you did okay." He says, "From now on, this is your meeting. Be here every Monday night at 7 o'clock. "Oh, I can't do that. My home group meets tonight." He says, "I don't care what meets tonight. You will be here every Monday night at 7 o'clock. And I took meetings in there for 6 years until it closed down. Then I moved to the next one and the next one, And I've been doing that for quite a while. Service, if it wasn't for service, I wouldn't be here. I'd be dead by now because I just couldn't do it. It's funny. My lovely wife Ellen's out here. The day we got married, we got married on the lawn of our place down on the water, and it was a beautiful day. Had a great time. We went over. We'd rented an inn for the dinner, and everybody was coming back to the house. Well, we got back to the house, and my sponsor came up to me and said, "Me and Wayne are going to go on a 12-step call. We hear that this guy." And I said, "Well, wait a minute." So I run over to Ellen and said, "Hey, honey, I'll be back in a little bit. I'm going on a 12-step call." I'm still in my tuxedo, man. She looked at me like, "You're going to what?" And she, I guess she'd rather have a sober husband than And she said, okay, honey. I said, but I'll drive by myself. I'll follow him so in case he gets carried away, I can come back. And she's like, yeah, okay. But, yeah, my lovely bride, she's a keeper. She's also in the program. oh, let's see. You know, AA, you know, this, the joy of helping others, you know, it's funny, just to regress here, I remember I was about 6 months sober and I was walking through the house and I happened to just, you know when you're walking and you just glance up and you see a reflection of yourself, and I had a smile on my face. It had been years since I remember smiling. And I remember saying to myself, man, this AA stuff kind of works, you know? And I remembered what Melvin said, you know, don't quit before the miracle happens, you know? And I remember the one thing I wanted the most when I first got to AA was to be able to forget the humiliation of my past. I was so embarrassed for what I put my mother through, and my brother, you know. But what I, you know, by sticking around and doing the work, I found out that it was absolutely, my past is the strongest and the biggest tool I have in my spiritual toolkit. You know, that I can share it with other people and, you know, help other guys that have been in my situation that I was. And I can show them that, you know, anything's possible. I had to resign a federal position that was a good job that I'd held for almost 18 years to go to jail. You know, and all my friends, don't worry. Your job will be waiting for you when you get out. Everything's going to be cool. When Tom got out of jail, it was, hey, guys, Tom who? You know, couldn't get a job. Well, I didn't quit. I kept doing what I was supposed to do. I was a little frustrated, but my sponsor said, well, since you have so much time on your hands, go to two meetings a day instead of one. Yeah, huh? And so I did what I had to do. And lo and behold, a guy that I used to work with vouched for me at another agency. And I'm here to tell you, I just retired. Well, not just retired, but I did retire with 38 years of federal service at a very high, I mean, it's great. It's great. I never thought it was possible. And I shared that with the guys in jail. You know, I'm a convicted felon, and I retired as a branch chief, you know. I had to start at the bottom of the heap, but the guy that hired me worked for me when I left. You know, who's to say? I watched, and me and my wife talk about this all the time. You cannot outgive God. The more you give to others, the more you get. You know, it's, I feel like, you know, in AA, I feel like I'm a dog chasing my tail. Because the more I give, the more I get. The more I get, the more I owe. And it just keeps going and going and going. And the beautiful thing about this is that it's just not an AA. You know, it's easy to be smiley and sober when you're in an AA meeting or you're helping your district or at a picnic, stuff like that. But this goes out into all aspects of my life. I was able, my youngest son, Jeremy, has Down syndrome. And, you know, when I was released from jail, he was at the age where I needed to do something to help him. And I was able to be a part. I was able to help start Challenger Baseball, which is for special needs children, you know, emotional, mental, physical, handicapped kids in Woodbridge, Virginia. And I was able to, you know, coach for 6 years. And the joy that I got out of watching these kids, you know, in their wheelchairs, with their braces, and And I also, you know, I coached my other son's team at the same time. And I went to the coaches meeting and I asked if any of the coaches, if they, any of their teams would like to be buddies, you know, have a handicapped kid and a normal kid play alongside of them to help them. And it was just amazing to watch the bonds that came between. These guys were actually fighting amongst themselves to who's going to be whose buddy. I mean, it was amazing, the friendships that were made. You know, kids that normally wouldn't even talk to each other. And to be part of that and to watch that kind of stuff happen, it was just, it was just absolutely amazing. You know, God is, like I said, God has been very, very good to me. I've had a lot of good things happen. I've been able to do a lot of good things. That if somebody would have told me that I would do some of the things I've done, I would have looked at them and said, yeah, like, that's really going to happen? You're out of your mind. We bought a house up in Steubenville, Ohio, for our daughter when she went to grad school, become a youth minister. My wife conned me into believing that it was going to be an investment property. Well, that wasn't the case. And it got to be a point where I was ready to shoot myself over this thing. And I was able to research and find a place. There was a charity up there that really did really great work with the homeless, you know. And I was able to give it to them, you know, donate it to them, so they could help, you know, battered women and the homeless and that kind of stuff. And God made that possible. You know, being sober made that possible. I didn't have a heart for that kind of stuff until I came here and started living these principles in my life. We have a guy, Steve, who lives with us. Lives with my wife and I. We let him move in with him after the second time he'd been in the penitentiary. And he's been a godsend. My son Jeremy loves him. I mean, he has become part of the family. He's been with us for 6-7 years now. I don't know. I can't even remember. It's been so long. If somebody would have told me that I was going to bring somebody like that in, and I can't tell you how many times I've brought guys that had gotten out of jail and let them stay with us for a day or two or whatever. You know, that's just okay. My name, phone number, is on the wall at the local jail in the treatment dorm, you know, for guys to call me, you know, when they get out, if they're going to get out. You know, I'll help them. Our doctor and our priest have my wife and my phone number so that if there's somebody in the church or, you know, if they know somebody that needs help, they call us. And they have. You know, it's been pretty cool. Now, we did take in a young lady not that long ago. I brought her home from a meeting, but you, the one that kept her. That was kind of cool. I came home and said, Helen was in bed. Honey, I brought this girl home from G Street. She looked at me like, she's leaving tomorrow, right? Yes, dear. But they talked, and so she stayed, and then we took her, she turned herself in. And then, but when she got out, she came and stayed with us, and that didn't quite work as well as all the rest of them. She kind of got us pretty good, but you know, that you can't, you know, you give, and what happens, happens. You know, it's in God's hands, and I'm not going to let that bad experience, you know, stop me from doing what God wants me to do, you know? You know, we give, and I don't expect anything in return, you know, I don't know what the outcome is going to be. I can just have the heart to do it. All I know, it's been my experience that when I'm doing something for somebody else or I'm helping another alcoholic, I'm not worrying about what's going on in my life. And I'll give you a perfect example. My mother was just diagnosed with stage four cancer. And for the past couple weeks, I have been spending all the time up there, you know, between Ellen, myself, my brother, and his wife. We've been rotating, you know. And I have these two sponsees, but one in particular. This guy is, I mean, I think he thinks an hour to figure out what color underwear to put on. I mean, he is the thinkingest dude over the dumbest stuff. And he calls me every day with this stuff, and it just makes me laugh. And I can't tell you how much it helps me to talk to this guy, you know, because it takes my mind off and it gives me a smile. And, you know, when things are really bad, he always calls at the right time, you know, talking about cancer and dying and, you know, how do you want, you know, what do you want your funeral and da-da-da. And this clown calls me up with a stupid-ass, you know, God, it's just hysterical. But and another example is I had a knee replacement, and I was feeling like crap, you know, and I was feeling sorry for myself. And I get home, you know, we come home, and we rented a hospital bed and put it in the living room. And phone rings, you know. I pick the phone up. Hey, Tom, this is Intergroup. Turning the phones over to you. What? Okay. So, no, you know, no going to sleep now. I got to sit here and answer the phones for Intergroup, you know. You know, God does for me what I can't do for myself. And it's a blessing, you know. It is truly a blessing. I came in here a totally broken vessel. And I'll give you one more example. Ellen and I were sitting here watching a TV show. Actually, I'll give you two. I'm watching a TV show. Tell me what I'm doing. Okay. We were watching a TV show, right? It was some stupid thing, like a dog or something got hit by a car or something. And I'm, you know, tears rolling down my face. And she looks at me and gets to giggling. And I'm going, shut up, you know. And, you know, I said, I couldn't believe it, you know. I said, but it's great. I can feel today, you know. Years ago, man, I mean, I don't want to get into gruesome and stuff like that, but I had no feelings, man. I would have just seen that kind of stuff. Nothing bothered me. I had no feelings. I was like, it was all just black. Ellen's WW number three, wonderful wife number three. Well, WW number two was the Antichrist. And we were married when I was still out there, and so was she. Well, I got sober, she didn't. And she was dying, and she was dying a really ugly death. But this was just before it happened. And Ellen, we were watching TV one day, and Ellen goes to me. She says, you know, Tom, there's going to come a time when Debbie's going to need help that her family won't be able to give her, and she'll probably have to rely on you and me, and I want you to know that I'm okay with that. And it just floored me. I mean, I started crying. I honestly did. I said, you realize if the shoe was on the other foot, she wouldn't cross the street to give you. And she said, that's not important. She said, this is for you, and, you know, and for her. But, and I'll be damned if it didn't happen. Or she had to come and stay with us for a short period of time because she couldn't live where she was because of the steps and stuff like that. I don't know too many people that would, you know, bring somebody in that who the person hated her guts, you know. But that's how it is in our house, you know. I couldn't ask for a mature partner, you know, and a more loving partner, because that's how we live our lives. You know, we get joy out of helping others. You know, we want to be happy, joyous, and free. You know, it's in all parts of our lives. You know, I'm on the men's ministry at our church. My wife's on the women's ministry at church. You know, we We help the homeless. We, you know, I almost sound like a saint because I'm not a saint, believe me. Far from it. Right, Cindy? But I'm 63 years old, and my mother, who is 89, she still gives me a hard time about, you know, you do too much. You're going all the time. Blah, blah, blah. Hey, Mom, you want the old time back? Oh, you just make sure you get enough rest. Well, I want to thank you for being here, and thanks for letting me share. And you all have a great conference. Thank you.
All right. If you would help me thank all three of our speakers, Tom, Gordon, and Sue.